Hello, and welcome back to In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. I'm your host, Paul Townsend. Today, we're going to do something a little different again. I received an email asking if we can look into some of the transformative cases in American criminal law, not just cases where people know the defendant because he or she is a celebrity or famous, but cases which resulted in real changes to the system. And then I was asked to provide some thoughts about whether these changes were positive or negative. So I thought this was an excellent idea. And from time to time, I will be sprinkling in cases like this one. In the United States, you have the right to remain silent. You have the right to know that anything that you say to law enforcement can be used against you in court. You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, you have the right to have an attorney appointed to represent you at no cost. You have the right to have that attorney present anytime law enforcement seeks to question you. Everyone here is familiar with that spiel. The rote language has thoroughly become enmeshed in American society. We're all aware of these rights. TV and movie cops and federal agents all give basically the same speech anytime an on-screen arrest is made or someone is brought in for questioning. We know this paragraph collectively as a person's Miranda rights. But while these protections were built into the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, they weren't always so universally known and understood by every level of society. Today, you'd be hard-pressed to find any adult who isn't familiar with his or her Miranda rights. But before 1966, the opposite would be true. Only a tiny fraction of the population had ever taken the time to actually read, digest, and analyze the constitutional provisions regarding a criminal defendant's rights. And there was certainly no great publication or dissemination of that information outside of law schools. So how did we get from a population utterly ignorant of their constitutional safeguards to a national community which can rattle them off without really even thinking about it? The answer to that question begins in Arizona in 1963, where 22-year-old Ernesto Miranda was arrested for the kidnapping and rape of a 17-year-old girl. What unfolded with this case changed the course of American legal philosophy and led to an unimaginable expansion of people's knowledge regarding their own constitutional rights. This is Miranda v. Arizona. Ernesto Miranda was born March 9, 1941, in Mesa, Arizona. His mother died when he was young, and Miranda never really got along with his father, who remarried a woman who also wanted very little to do with him. As with so many children growing up neglected and without the appropriate amount of attention or guidance, Miranda began acting out early in his childhood. By eighth grade, he had already been convicted of a crime. In his first year of high school, he was then convicted of burglary and sentenced to a year in reform school, the Arizona State Industrial School for Boys. After this year, he was released, but only for about a month, at which point he was rearrested, convicted, and sent right back to reform school. At this point, his father and stepmother have washed their hands of him and wanted really nothing more to do with him. When Miranda was 16, he was released from reform school for the second time. He packed up and moved to California. A few short months later, he was again arrested, this time for armed robbery and some sex offenses, though he was never convicted of these. But after his Los Angeles case had concluded, he spent the next several years drifting throughout the southern states, getting into trouble here and there. He was arrested in Texas. He did federal time in Ohio and California for stealing a car and driving it across state lines. After serving his federal time, Miranda appeared to straighten up a bit. He worked as a loading dock laborer in Phoenix, Arizona for quite some time, and had begun a relationship with a woman named Twyla Hoffman. Outwardly, things seemed to be turning around for Ernesto Miranda. This all fell apart on March 13th, 1963. Miranda was driving his truck through Phoenix, Arizona, when it was spotted by the brother of Lois Ann Jameson, a 17-year-old girl who had been kidnapped and raped 10 days prior. Jameson had given her brother a description of her attacker and the license plate of his truck, both of which the brother claimed matched Miranda. The Jamesons called the police, and officers Carol Cooley and Wilfred Young went to the local Phoenix, Arizona Department of Motor Vehicles and obtained the registration information for the truck. That led them to get in contact with Miranda, who agreed to voluntarily come down to the police station and participate in a lineup. Miranda arrived at the station and was not placed under arrest. He was put in the lineup, and at the conclusion of the proceeding, he asked how he had done. Now, it's really unclear whether Miranda was actually positively identified in the lineup. However, we do know that the officers told him that he was positively identified, and Miranda, at that point, is placed under arrest and taken to an interrogation room. Now, it's really essential to keep in mind that at this time, criminal defendants have rights, but law enforcement was under no obligation to make sure that the defendants knew they had rights. It was the responsibility of each citizen to know their rights, and the police were not required to make their own jobs harder by informing people placed under arrest that they had no obligation to assist the police in obtaining evidence against them. Miranda was interrogated for around 2 hours and ultimately handwrote a confession to the kidnapping and rape. Now, at no point during the interrogation was Miranda ever told that he had the right to have an attorney present while he was being questioned, or that he even had the right to remain silent and to refuse to answer any questions. On the top of each sheet of his written confession was the statement, quote, "This statement has been made voluntarily and of my own free will, with no threats, coercion, or promises of immunity, and with full knowledge of my legal rights, understanding any statement I make can and will be used against me," end quote. After he made the confession, he was brought out to where Miss Jameson was sitting, and in the presence of the officers and Miss Jameson, Miranda said, quote, "That's the girl," end quote. At which point, Lois Jameson told officers that Miranda's voice matched her attacker's as well. Armed with the written confession, the verbal affirmation identifying the victim, the license plates, and the victim's voice identification, the case was given to the Maricopa County Prosecutor's Office. Now, in past episodes, we've talked about how serious cases can take years to go to trial. But the 1960s were a different time. Cases didn't linger, especially in jurisdictions which would be considered to lean towards a more pro-prosecution bend. And Maricopa County could rightly be considered a law and order jurisdiction at the time. After being arrested on March 13, 1963, Miranda was assigned 73-year-old Alvin Moore as his lawyer. The trial began approximately 3 months later, in mid-June of 1963. The trial was held in front of the Honorable Judge Yale McFate. Judge McFate was born in 1910, before Arizona was even a state. He was from the old school, serving both as a legislator and on the Arizona Corporation Commission, in addition to being a state court judge. By all accounts, he was fairly stern and upheld the law as he believed it to be, which was interesting because Judge McFate never went to law school. During the trial, the prosecutor on the case, Bob Corbin, sought to introduce Miranda's written confession. Alvin Moore objected, which apparently surprised Judge McFate. Moore initially argued that the confession was taken without Miranda being aware of his right to remain silent or his right to counsel, and thus it violated his constitutional rights. Even the document itself purported to show that Miranda was making the confession while fully aware of his rights, but that was simply not true. Judge McFate, to his credit, allowed full arguments on the topic by both sides. Moore argued that the protections and guarantees are meaningless if the defendant is unaware that he has them, and that the officers took the confession knowing that Miranda believed he knew his rights, but in actuality did not. Corbin, the county prosecutor, argued that the officers were under no affirmative obligation to tell Miranda what his rights were. He had these rights, and had he asserted his right to remain silent or requested an attorney, the officers would have respected these desires. As it was, he did agree to answer questions, and he never asked for a lawyer. The law, Corbin asserted, put no affirmative burden on law enforcement to ensure that a defendant is verbally informed of his rights. They are presumed to know their rights as long as the officers did not refuse to permit the defendant from asserting those rights, then they did nothing wrong. Let's look a little more in depth at these arguments. They both make what I think are very valid points, and they were both well articulated in the Maricopa County Trial Court in 1963. Alvin Moore was making an argument based on policy. He was saying that it would be an institutional defect to have all Americans be holders of these constitutional rights, but not assert them because there is no policy in place to ensure that they even know that they exist. Frequently, the people who are most in need of the protections that these rights afford are not the people who are likely to be casually leafing through a pocket constitution for fun and stumble across the provisions in the first 14 amendments which define the limits of permissible government action. The protections exist, whether the person knows about them or not, but if the defendant is not aware of them, then they don't actually protect anything, rendering them moot. So are we, as a society, willing to conclude that the framers of the Constitution only wanted these protections to apply to people savvy enough to look them up and read them for themselves and then have the temerity to forcefully assert them in an interrogation room full of badges? Alvin Moore's position was that it should be the responsibility of the government to ensure that its citizens are aware of their rights and make informed decisions based on that knowledge. The police are an institutional extension of that government, and therefore should be ensuring that people know their rights. I'm going to let that argument sink in for a moment, because there's a lot to it, and it's fairly dense. Okay, so you have Moore's position. Now let's talk about what Bob Corbin argued. Corbin made a text-based argument, or rather a lack of text-based argument. Nowhere in the constitutions of the United States or Arizona is it written anywhere that law enforcement, in addition to investigating criminal activity and bringing those responsible to justice, should also be required to hamstring their own activities by informing criminal defendants of rights which they ought to know on their own. The job of the police department is to determine whether crimes have been committed, investigate, and arrest the offenders. They are not a public service announcement organization. Telling everyone who gets put into an interrogation room that they have the right to frustrate police efforts to collect evidence and discover the truth. Corbin argued that this is not a case of police misconduct. The officers did not coerce a confession. No threats or promises were made, and at no point did the officers tell Miranda that he was under an obligation to answer all their questions. They merely failed to inform Miranda that he had the option to refuse to answer or to consult with a lawyer. It is not disputed that Miranda never asked for a lawyer, and Corbin argued that if he had, that would have ended the interrogation. But unless a defendant asserts his rights, there is no authority which says that the police should be required to affirmatively offer a criminal defendant the opportunity to stay quiet. Nobody has to tell a newspaper that they have the right to print what they want. Nobody has to tell a priest, rabbi, or imam that they have the right to worship whatever deity that they want. And nobody has to tell the Sierra Club or the Freemasons that they have a constitutional right to assemble. These people and organizations know they have these rights because they took it upon themselves to learn. So why should we treat criminal defendants differently? The major distinction in this argument is commission versus omission. The prosecution argued that law enforcement is prohibited from violating an individual's rights, whether that be an illegal search under the Fourth Amendment, a coerced confession under the Fifth Amendment, refusal to allow defendant to have a lawyer under the Sixth Amendment, or refusal of any state to apply these protections under the 14th Amendment. That would be an error of commission, because the state has acted in a way that affirmatively violated an individual right. That would be different than an act of omission, where law enforcement would simply not inform a defendant that he or she has certain rights. The officers do not know at that point whether the defendant, in this case Ernesto Miranda, knows that he has the right to remain silent and is choosing to speak, and or do not know whether Miranda is aware that refusing to answer questions is an option. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter, because he answered the questions voluntarily. The bottom line in the prosecution's argument was that the police shouldn't need to go above and beyond what the law requires. To exclude a confession because the police did not sit the defendant down and walk through the entire Bill of Rights with him, pausing after each amendment to make sure the defendant understood that he had a further ability to frustrate law enforcement, is tying the police department's hands behind their back in a wholly inappropriate way. Judge McFate considered the arguments raised by Moore and Corbin, and then promptly decided to admit the confession. He agreed with the prosecution that there is no rule that the police officers had to ensure that Miranda was aware of his rights. It was simply enough that they did not affirmatively violate them. The confession sank Miranda at trial. He was convicted and sentenced to 20 to 30 years concurrently for both the kidnapping and rape. We've covered this previously in other episodes, but let's just refresh what we mean by concurrent as opposed to consecutive sentencing. This is something that seems to give a lot of people hang-ups, and I have noticed, especially recently in the media, a lot of journalists have no idea what the difference is and misrepresent the total potential prison sentence a person may be facing as a result. Let's take an example to really drive this home. Let's say that Kaylee, Alexandra, and Ethan decide to rob a bank. They decide they are going to jointly buy a gun, steal a car, hold up the bank, use the stolen car to get away, and then set the car on fire. Alexandra, the ringleader here, selects the bank, selects the day, and contacts a person to purchase a gun. Everyone pools their money for the gun and goes to pick it up. They leave their back alley gun purchase and immediately flag down a motorist on the street. Kaylee points the gun in the motorist's face and demands that he gets out of his vehicle and run away as fast as he can. The driver promptly complies. Ethan gets behind the wheel, Kaylee tucks the gun in her waistband, gets in the back, and Alexandra gets in the passenger seat. The three make their way to Janey Savings and Loan. They pull up out front, Kaylee and Alexandra get out, go in and rob the bank, then jump in the car that Ethan has kept running, and take off. 10 miles outside town, they douse the car with gasoline, light it on fire, Immediately, they are surrounded by lights and sirens. Now, in this made-up hypothetical, let's say our three miscreants are charged with the following. Conspiracy to rob a bank with a 10-year maximum. Criminal possession of a weapon with an 8-year maximum. Robbery of an automobile, the 5-year maximum. Bank robbery with a 15-year maximum. And destruction of property for torching the car, 2-year maximum. Journalists who cover the case would look at these charges and rush to put out headlines saying that Ethan, Kaylee, and Alexandra are each facing 40 years in jail if convicted. But that's because journalists rarely bothered to do research. In reality, when criminals commit various crimes in the same basic endeavor, these crimes are viewed as one umbrella act. And because of that, the sentences which they receive for their actions run concurrently. Because in the United States, we don't punish people multiple times for the same basic behavior. Accordingly, in our hypothetical, Alexandra, Ethan, and Kaylee are looking at 10 years, 8 years, 5 years, 15 years, and 2 years running concurrently. This means that all of these sentences will overlap and run at the exact same time. The 15 years for the bank robbery will be the controlling sentence, as this is the one that, once served, will trigger release. From the first day they step into prison, all the sentences will start to run. So after 2 years, the sentence for torching the car will be done. At the 5-year mark, they will have fully served the sentence for the robbery of the car. But they'll stay in prison until the longest sentence is served, at which point they'll be released. Now, the reason that they're sentenced on everything instead of just the longest is that if, say, we tweak our hypothetical a bit and say now that evidence has come out later that definitively shows that Kaylee honestly believed the bank robbery was not going to happen, she was just there to buy a gun and steal a car. In that unlikely event, her conviction for the bank robbery and conspiracy to rob the bank would be overturned. She would still have to serve the remaining concurrent sentences. So sentencing for each count is a way to ensure that no matter how appeals are resolved, there is a sentence imposed to cover the most serious crime left standing. Okay, so now let's look at consecutive sentencing. We'll take two people, let's call them Bonnie and Clyde as an example. Now, Bonnie and Clyde are bad people, and they have a friend named Jim. So first, they rob a bank with Jim. They split the money evenly and split up. A week later, Bonnie and Clyde call Jim and set up a meeting. They kill Jim because he knew about the robbery. A week later, after that, Bonnie and Clyde find out that Jim told Alice about the robbery. So they kill her too. And once Alice is killed, Bonnie and Clyde are surrounded by the familiar blue and red lights and sirens. Now in this hypothetical, Bonnie and Clyde are charged with the following. Bank robbery, 15-year max. Murder of Jim, 30-year max. Murder of Alice, 30-year max. But in this case, because Bonnie and Clyde had multiple different criminal actions that weren't all part of the same immediate series of events, a judge could and should look at these and determine that each action was a separate criminal occurrence should be dealt with accordingly. Even though they all stem from the same basic criminal activity, the fact that they're separated in time, separated by planning, and constitute different actions will allow a judge to view them each independently. Accordingly, Bonnie and Clyde should be facing 15 years, and then 30 years, and then another 30 years total. The sentences should run consecutively because their criminal activity should be considered separate individual acts and be added back to back as opposed to overlapping. Separate acts considered together as opposed to one criminal act. That's the consideration. In Miranda's case, he was convicted of basically one criminal act, the kidnapping and rape, and he was sentenced to 20 to 30 years concurrently on both. Accordingly, if he ever got a conviction on one overturned, the other would still stand. So the next time you see a news article covering a person charged with multiple crimes from one continuous criminal action, where the reporter says, if convicted, the person faces a maximum of 250 years, you'll know the author of the article probably has no idea what he or she is talking about. Okay, with that in mind, let's take a look at Miranda's appeal. First, he appealed to the Appellate Division of the Arizona State Court. Alvin Moore continued to represent him. He submitted his papers claiming that the system was wrong, the policy here was wrong, and that this conviction was inappropriate as a result. He made the same argument that he made in front of Judge McFate. The same arguments were heard by the Arizona Appellate Court as were heard by Judge McFate. The Appellate Court came down and agreed with the trial court. So Miranda next appealed to the Arizona State Supreme Court, wherein he got the same treatment as he received below. Moore, who deeply felt that his client had been wrong in terms of his confession, continued to argue all the way through the Arizona Supreme Court that Miranda's confession was taken in violation of his constitutional rights. But in 1963 and 1964, nobody really was entertaining the idea that a criminal defendant who made a voluntary confession to an egregious criminal act, who admitted that he wasn't coerced or tricked into making the confession, or even that the police did anything other than ask him what happened, should be protected from such a statement. Most people, especially those in black robes in the Arizona judiciary, were willing to say if the police didn't cross any lines, that Miranda's confession did not violate any rules, laws, or amendments, and that Miranda should go to jail. Ernest Miranda appealed to the Supreme Court of the United States. Let's take just a brief second and talk about how that can happen. A person convicted in state court cannot simply appeal their case to the United States Supreme Court. There are certain criteria that the case has to meet in order for the Supreme Court of the United States to even have jurisdiction to hear the appeal. Now, there are a couple ways that a case can get up to the Supreme Court, and I'm not going to list them all because this is not a constitutional law class in law school. But one of the more interesting avenues for Supreme Court jurisprudence is if a state court case touches on a constitutional issue, which the lawyers are disputing heavily, and which bears upon a constitutional right. Well, hello, Ernest Miranda. This case really struck a chord with the Supreme Court. It touched upon a litany of potential constitutional issues and went to the very heart of what a defendant was entitled to as a matter of constitutional law. The Supreme Court agreed to hear the case in November of 1965. One thing that will entice the Supreme Court to weigh in on certain issues is when various jurisdictions handle similar issues in starkly different ways. So the Supreme Court wants to deliver some unanimity to the group so that everyone understands what the Constitution requires and how it views certain situations. The decision rendered in Maricopa County v. Miranda was in stark contrast to another case at the time, Escobedo v. Illinois, which had held that attorney presence during questioning was a fundamental right and could not be abridged absent a knowing and explicit waiver. The defendant had to be told that he had a right to a lawyer and affirmatively tell the police that he would speak to them without one. But with this controversy to be resolved, and a constitutional issue of what exactly is encompassed in a person's Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights, the Supreme Court elected to hear Miranda's case. Unfortunately, Alvin Moore could not continue as Miranda's lawyer due to health concerns from his age, so John Paul Frank, a former law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black, took over representation of Miranda and argued his case in front of the Supreme Court. The state of Arizona was represented by a man named Gary Nelson. Miranda was made the representative case for a number of cases who had made their way to the Supreme Court at the same time and dealt with more or less the same issue. Vignera versus New York, Westover versus United States, and California versus Stewart all dealt with issues relating to the right to remain silent and the right to counsel. In this circumstance, the Supreme Court felt it appropriate to delineate the constitutional rights of criminal defendants for all jurisdictions. The ruling would apply to each and every person arrested for a crime, whether it be federal or state, in any jurisdiction, because these particular rights implicated would be triggered either by the Bill of Rights or the 14th Amendment in each and every situation. John Paul Frank appeared in front of the Supreme Court and gave a similar articulation of the same argument which was put forth by Alvin Moore in the Arizona State Court. The right to counsel and the right to remain silent are fundamental rights to each and every citizen. They should not apply only to those who know enough to assert them. Before speaking with law enforcement, a person should be fully aware of their right not to do so, and the right to consult with a lawyer before he or she says anything. Gary Nelson made the straight argument, which had prevailed in every jurisdiction at this point, except for Illinois. He claimed that a police officer has a responsibility not to violate rights asserted by a criminal defendant, but has no affirmative duty to explain what those rights are. It is not a police officer's job to inform a private citizen what the Constitution affords them in the context of questioning about criminal activity. It was a similar song and dance that happened at the trial court level at this case, but with far greater implications. We're looking at the Supreme Court in 1966. This is the period of American jurisprudence known as the Warren Court. This would rightly be considered one of the most pro-defendant eras of Supreme Court jurisprudence and established a lot of the foundational rights which people take for granted today. Upon consideration of the arguments, the court ruled 5-4 in favor of Miranda, which means that if a single other justice had had reservations about the case, an entire 60 years of progress would have been wiped out. We need to always be mindful of that when we look at the cases the Supreme Court agrees to take. The rule of four was discussed in previous episodes, and we don't really have time to revisit it here, but look up the rule of four if you're interested in how the Supreme Court determines what cases to hear procedurally. So here we go. The actual ruling in Miranda v. Arizona was that a person in custody must, prior to interrogation, be clearly informed that he or she has the right to remain silent, and that anything that he or she says can and will be used against them, and the defendant must be clearly informed that he or she has the right to consult with a lawyer and have that lawyer present with them during interrogation. Further, if they cannot afford a lawyer, that a lawyer would be appointed for them and paid for by the state. Let's be clear, this was a 5-4 decision, meaning it turned on whether a muse smiled at a justice that morning in the gallery. But it has had more impact on American criminal law than anything else in the history of this country. Police have always had the opportunity to corner suspects, question them, and ascertain what they did. But now, all of a sudden, because of a crazy runaway Supreme Court decision, all of these guilty criminal masterminds were now required to be given the opportunity to tell law enforcement to take a hike. Let's quickly clear up one very common misconception about Miranda warnings. They are required prior to a police interrogation. They are not required to be given upon an arrest. Arrests are never null and void because the police did not give the person Miranda warnings as cuffs were being put on. Miranda applies when a person is being subject to a custodial interrogation. Miranda's conviction was overturned. It was sent back to the Arizona Criminal Court. He was retried without the confession and reconvicted. The evidence was fairly strong against him even without the confession, and Twyla Hoffman, his then-girlfriend, testified that he had actually spoken to her about the kidnapping and the rape. After he was convicted again, Miranda was actually granted parole in 1972. He then tried to trade off his name after his release and make a living signing Miranda cards, which were by now being carried by law enforcement. But apparently nobody really wanted his signature, and he was stabbed to death in 1976 in a bar over an argument on his involvement with Miranda cards. In summation, let's take a moment to look at where the country was pre-Miranda and where we've had the good fortune to wind up. In the early 1960s, life for anyone accused of a crime was pretty bleak, unless you happened to memorize your constitutional rights ahead of time. You had your protections, federal and or state, but only to the extent that you were knowledgeable and confident enough to assert them. It strikes me that anyone consulted today has no qualms with the idea that a person arrested for a crime has the right to remain silent and have a lawyer appointed for them. We all accept this. We take it for granted, because for most of us, this is how we grew up. This is a basic tenet of life in the United States. But let's take a quick step back and look at what life was like before this ruling. The rule was that the police couldn't infringe on a person's rights. If the defendant didn't know that those rights existed, if they assented to an interview, then hey, they were waiving them. In my opinion, much as I am wary of agreeing with policy views of constitutional law over a textual analysis, this was the right outcome. I also think the bigger story here isn't that Miranda made the practice of informing a criminal defendant about his or her rights generally applicable, but rather that it actually became generally applicable. As of June 13th, 1966, cops on the beat in Flatulence, Wyoming, would have to tell an arrestee that they have a right to a lawyer, and they have the right to remain silent. That was completely bonkers to most other people. It had never been a thing before. If you follow this podcast at all, you have an idea about how I feel about certain issues. I'm very much a pro-individual rights person. I think people should take the time and effort to learn about their rights. But I also feel that the government should inform people of their rights prior to trying to take them away. While I'm sympathetic to Judge Harlan's dissent in the Miranda decision, I cannot fully get on board with him. Harlan wrote, quote, "The court is forever adding new stories to the temples of constitutional law. And the temples have a way of collapsing when one story too many is added," end quote. He believed that nothing in the Constitution supported the decision of the majority. And while the text itself does not explicitly state that law enforcement should proactively inform criminal defendants of their rights, I think it's more important to look at the whole picture. What was the point in crafting these rights? If we conclude, as I believe we should, that the point was to protect individuals from intrusion by the state, then it makes perfect sense that the authors of those rights would want to make sure that they were explained to each individual prior to the state attempting to intrude on them. And for that reason, I agree with this decision, which is easy to say nearly 60 years later when we've seen how it played out. But I encourage all listeners to take a step back and think about Miranda in this new light. I think it's healthy to put yourself in Bob Corbin's shoes, arguing in front of Judge Yale McFate that Alvin Moore's theory that Miranda's rights were infringed simply because he was never told about them was beyond what any court had ever concluded before. I think it'll give you a whole new appreciation for what the Supreme Court did in the Miranda decision to protect those accused of committing crimes. So, now you're an expert in the legal history of the Miranda warnings. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you did, please subscribe so you'll get notified when the next episode gets published. On that note, please also check out the show's new InSummation Instagram page, and also check out my law firm's Instagram page as well, RCGA_NY. Follow me as I strive to learn how to link posts from the website to various forms of social media. Also, feel free to visit the show's website, insummation.com, where you can see clips of legal commentary that I do for the Law and Crime Network, or read articles that I write, which expound on some of the show's topics. And you can leave me feedback there. You can also write to me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com, find the show's page on Facebook, tweet me at insummationpod, or look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. Keep the feedback flowing. I always appreciate hearing from listeners and do try to respond to every message I get. And as always, a special thank you to Dan Townsend, who does amazing work in short time periods to keep everything on schedule and smooth. I cannot thank you enough, little brother. I would also like to send a special thank you to Kaylee Kreitenberg, who is patiently trying to teach me how to use social media. If you have a specific case or legal topic you would like to see covered in the show, please send me a message, and I'll do my best to cover it, like this episode. Thanks so much for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.